Welcome to Theology of the Buddy, a podcast for Catholics who love the beauty of the Church's sacred tradition. My name is Mike, and if you're looking to grow in the faith in new ways, looking to connect with other faithful Catholics, or you're simply looking to find out why Dominicans are better than Carmelites, you've come to the right place. So if you haven't yet, make sure you hit that subscribe button wherever you're listening, and don't forget to drop by theologyofthebuddy.com for all of our show notes and past episodes. Chris is going to love that intro. All right, let's get into the podcast today. I'm joined by friend, fellow Holy Angels parishioner, and fellow Order of Preachers appreciator, Owen. Welcome to the podcast, Owen.
Thanks, Mike. It's good to be here.
How you doing, Owen? How's your Easter been?
Easter's been good. Been quite busy. Just busy with work and stuff like that. So I'm studying to be a carpenter by trade. Yeah, it's still on a kind of wait list to get into school and stuff like that, but it's a lot of waiting, but it's the work itself is quite good. I'm always learning something new and stuff, so yeah.
You're in construction right now?
Yeah, in construction, so carpentry kind of just does everything from flooring to building the walls of houses and to, pretty much everything, a lot of stuff and awesome. Goes involved into it, yeah.
It's a good trade. I heard there was maybe a saint that was a carpenter one time.
Oh, yeah. What was his name again? But actually, the patron saint of construction workers is Saint Vincent Ferrer.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I was happy to find that out. So that's pretty cool.
It seems kind of random to me. Yeah. Do you know if there's a reason to it? Or
there is a story behind that. So as many holy men and women do, saintly ones, anyways, they go around performing miracles. And there was a time when Saint Vincent Ferrer was performing miracles. I think it was around the same time of this story of it was a town that he was visiting, and there was a great shortage of food or something, I think, at the time. And they, I guess he had kind of a foreknowledge of that there was a ship about to come in to the harbor with a lot of food for the town, and he had kind of made this known to the people in his sermon ahead of time. And a lot of people became outraged because they couldn't possibly see how he would have known that. And I think some reports went back to his superior, and they kind of just was, his superior was like, listen, you have to stop these kinds of things. You can't just say things like that. These people are starving. And of course, under obedience, he did. I think then a few days later, then the actual ship showed up, and they were all just very, very shocked by it. But his bishop hadn't told him anything different since. But meanwhile, the few days after that, I think there was a construction being built on the church, and there was a young man up there, and he had seen Father or Friar Vincent walking down the street, and was kind of trying to get a good look at him, and accidentally fell from the scaffolding that he was on, and he called out to, he says, "Dear Father or Friar Vincent, please save me." And then Saint Vincent looks up and says, "Stop." Like as loud as he could, and this young man stopped in midair, and he said, "I will be right back to you." He goes to his superior and says, "There's a young man who needs my help right now." And he goes, "Well, what do you mean?" He goes, "Well, he's fallen from the church that they're building." And he goes, "Well, you better go back and help him then." And then he goes, says, "He says, come down to me now." And slowly, slowly, slowly came down, and then safely landed onto the ground. But
thank God the superior said yes.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, there would have been a very
go back and say, sorry. I guess you have to fall to your death now.
Exactly. Yeah, but he, So I think that's the story. That Saint Vincent Ferrer is now the patron saint of construction workers. Yeah, so
that's a really cool story. Mm-hmm. I love that.
Yeah.
So as you may have guessed from the Dominican jokes and quips, we're here to talk about a specific subject, specifically a recent conference that Owen and I attended in Toronto on medieval Dominican liturgy. And so we're going to talk about that, some takeaways from it, and some stuff about the Dominican rite in general, and third orders, and just all good stuff. So I thought maybe as a starting point for this podcast, we could talk about what actually is the Dominican rite of the Mass, because many people probably don't know about it. I would say it's kind of memory hold. A lot of things before the council are forgotten now, but I find especially these other rites that used to exist beside the Roman rite are especially forgotten, even more than the traditional Latin Mass and the other devotions of the Latin rite.
Yeah, for sure.
So the most basic explanation would be before Trent and Quo Primum, there were a lot of different rites, and with Quo Primum, kind of establishing the Roman rite as
the rite
of the West, essentially.
Yeah.
The rule was anything newer than 200 years was suppressed in the West. And among the handful of rites that survived that, because they were older than that, is some of the rites of the religious orders. The Dominicans, the Carmelites, Cartusians.
Cistercians, too.
Cistercians. Okay. Maybe the Norbertines.
Most likely.
Anyway, there's a handful of them that all had their own rites of Mass, which, by and large, if you were to look at the missal or see one done, they're like 99% the same as the Roman rite.
Right.
But they have their own little unique things in them.
Yeah, especially when it comes to playing out within the liturgy, there's a lot of differences there. A lot of similarities, too. And
Little things about like the actions they do in the Mass, too, right?
Yeah. That
wouldn't necessarily jump out in the text, maybe.
Yeah. I think one of those things that we had seen at the conference was the priest was sitting down for one of the blessings or something along the side. I forget exactly what part of the Mass that was, but I was just kind of taken back by, I was like, oh, he's sitting for this part. But I think
there are other little details, like how during the readings, during the epistle and the gospel, the deacon, I believe it's the deacon, was doing other things.
Yeah.
Preparing the chalice and paten and stuff on the altar. So that's not done after the sermon by the priest. It's done
beforehand
during the chants.
Yeah.
I never looked up the actual name of this, but there's like a vestment that's placed over the priest's lap when he sits.
Right. Didn't we see that, I think?
We saw this during... So at the conference, they had a Dominican rite liturgy, a solemn high Mass.
On the feast of St. Thomas Aquinas.
Yes.
Is this a once-in-a-lifetime kind of thing? Yeah.
Yeah, so we saw this ritual with the... It was almost like a blanket, but it was like made of like the material that you'd expect on a fiddleback vestment or something, right? And they would place it over the priest, little things like that. It was pretty cool to see because this is, like, as Owen said, kind of a once-in-a-lifetime thing. We found out that at least the community where some of these priests were from, not all, but at least I believe Father Augustine was from this community where he said they had the only living tradition of saying the Dominican rite. Because most Dominicans adopted the Novus Ordo.
Right, yeah.
And apparently this group, they've never stopped using the traditional Dominican rite, at least for high feast days and anniversaries and things like that.
Right.
So that kind of shows how forgotten this rite is.
Yeah, and it's almost miraculous that they've kept it going for so long. Like that, like even they haven't been saying it. It's not a daily thing that they say, but it's a like as you said, on bigger feast days. But they're not also very common though either. So it's wonderful that they can kind of keep it going, that they have been. And I believe the Archbishop of Toronto gave the permission to have it said on this feast day, on that feast day, for this reasons.
Yeah, they did have explicit permission from Cardinal Collins. Which now is no longer in office, but he was then.
Right. It was unfortunate that he was supposed to be there for it, but did have a meeting instead with the bishop, with the other bishops, I believe. So, like, it just would have been quite a sight to see, like, a cardinal on there on the altar in the red as well.
You don't often see the cardinals at a traditional Mass.
No, especially not a Dominican rite one either,
Yeah, not a Canadian one. Like, I have once gone down to the States and seen Cardinal Burke at a Mass, but I don't know of any Canadian cardinals that I would ever think would be at a traditional Mass these days.
Very few.
So obviously that moment of having the solemn high Mass was obviously a high point of the conference. I wanted to ask you if there was anything else there that was a highlight for you?
So the night before we had the Vespers, it was just a sight to see all of the friars on the altar, like in just facing one another, like for choir. They had the leaflets there to, same for the mass as well. They had the leaflets so you could follow along, but I was kind of much more interested in just trying to kind of take it all in. Like, I know there's a lot of people taking photographs and stuff, lights flashing all the time, but I was kind of just trying to stay within the moment, just trying to observe, trying to take in some of what I was seeing happen. It was just a wonderful sight to see, just to see these men, just like, and to hear the choir, just to hear the office being sung and to hear it chanted, and to, yeah, just to kind of see what they do in their monastery, or in their friary, I should say, on a daily basis. So it's just really, really cool to see that. And then obviously the music, both for the mass and the Vespers, was just phenomenal. It was just kind of, it's one of those things where it'll stay with you for quite a while.
Yeah, it was very well done. And yeah. I mean, for us going as laymen, a lot of the conference had very academic talks and a lot of history and details of archaeology being discussed and stuff like that, which a lot of it was very interesting. 90% of it was over my head, but
same here.
But the liturgical aspect of it was.
We just should mention what the actual title of it was. It was the Medieval Manuscripts. Wasn't it the official title was the Medieval Manuscripts in the
of the conference?
The conference itself. It was because it was a very niche conference. Like it was centered around Dominican spirituality in some sense, but it was very, very precise to 13th century Dominican manuscripts and about the formation of Humbert of Romans and his codex and how he came to, and like just kind of a little bit of the history of like how that came about and the revisions. And so I guess that was the title of the conference. But then like some of the talks were kind of somewhat, I felt like, were more general, like some of them. But then there was I think there was two talks that kind of were just like, I think it went into great detail about the music notation, I think. I was just kind of, I was quite lost on that. I was like, it went into very, it was almost mathematical, and I was kind of getting lost at one point, or actually for most of that I was quite lost.
Yeah, there was one delving into poetry as well,
right,
with I believe it was Constant Muse.
Yes.
He had be quite lost.
Yeah, he had, because he had a great interest in Peter of Abelard and Heloise. He had wrote extensively on them, and on their letters. He had wrote quite a few commentaries on their letters, the exchange of their letters.
But the earlier section of the talks where it talked about the development of the altar missals, the reforms of Humbert of Romans, that part was very interesting. That was heavy on history, but it was followable.
Exactly.
Where you could find out all this information about Humbert. This is the master of the Dominican order in the 13th century. Who
was he, the fourth master general, I believe?
Or? That sounds about right.
Yeah, I think he was the fourth.
It's quite early. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it's within the same century, within something like 30, 40 years of the death of St. Dominic.
Yeah.
And he's the one who ordered the standardizing of the altar missals for the whole Dominican order.
And I think, wasn't that because that when Dominicans, because they are kind of missionary, that they travel a lot, like it was becoming very confusing and very difficult for visiting friars to other monasteries to follow along with each of these kind of unique idiosyncrasies that each friary had, or each house had, and just became very difficult for each person to kind of pick up on all of these things in a short space of time. So I guess you just kind of wanted some uniformity across the board. They were still allowing some, like you'll have your own, you can choose like some of the more your particular venerations or devotions on particular saints within the order or something like that, or to something to that effect, I believe. But he was like, there needs to be greater uniformity because it's very confusing for a lot of these visiting friars to kind of catch on quickly to.
Yeah, something we might not think about today is, because this was pre-Trent and pre-Coprimum, as I mentioned before, a lot of dioceses and cities had their own particular rites that had little variations from region to region. And this wasn't usually a big problem because they were like pre-Protestant Reformation, they were all very similar to the Roman Rite. Mm-hmm. And most priests didn't move around, right? You had your parish and you would live there and you would do that rite until you die, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And the people who lived there wouldn't travel much. And they would only know that rite.
Yeah.
But for an order of friars who travels a lot, if they learned the local rite in one place and then they travel, or they go to a friary in a different city, suddenly there's discord among them about exactly how to say the mass and stuff like that.
How to sing the office, where the emphasis lies and where it doesn't. And
So that's the value for the order of standardizing it. Yeah. So wherever they go, they're with their brother Dominicans. They know how to chant the office and how to say the mass.
Mm-hmm.
So I know we wanted to talk about some of the controversy, too, of the conference. Obviously, this is University of Toronto. It's not super trad just because they're having a
Dominican High Rite. Dominican Mass in the High. Yeah, High Dominican Mass.
Yeah.
High Mass, Dominican Rite. There we go.
Yeah. There we go. It's a traditional Mass, but it's not like it's put on by FSSP or something.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a little bit of modernism creeping into some things.
Mm-hmm.
There was the one talk that delved into a lot of really interesting history about the tomb of St. Thomas.
Yes, yeah.
And how it was built, how it was destroyed. And just, I distinctly remember the talk ending off with saying, basically, maybe it's a good thing it was destroyed because it was too ostentatious for St. Thomas. And I'm just rolling my eyes.
It didn't fit with the Dominican spirit of poverty, I think was the words that were used. But this, so it was a, what did they actually call it? It was a, so kind of a description of this is that it was 60 feet high and it had four decorative pillars, like on each corner of what would have been his actual tomb, and that they had designed four altars on each side of this as well, so that four masses could be happening simultaneously.
And this is all within the nave of a cathedral in France.
And then the French Revolution takes place.
And it's all gone and destroyed and looted.
Yeah.
In France.
Right. There was drawings of what it would have looked like, and I'm pretty sure that they would be easy to find online, but it just, it looked absolutely beautiful. But yeah, there's just an empty space right now with, I don't know if his tomb is still in the nave of the church.
I believe it may be in a side chapel or something, but it's underneath an altar.
Right.
Now there's some kind of reliquary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, a mausoleum. That's what I was thinking. That was the word I was trying to think of. Yeah. That's, I think that's what the actual thing on the screen had said. It was a mausoleum. And I was like, oh, okay. Yeah. So it's a kind of on the four-posted thing. It reminded me of St. Peter's, you know, just that decorative piece on the altar in St. Peter's, right where the Holy Father will like say masses, and with that right there behind him, and just the decoration and the just how much detail had it just was just incredible. So just to think that that's lost now, it's very sad.
Yeah, it's kind of funny the kind of weird applications of the spirit of poverty to the veneration of the saints, as if like because the brothers of the order take a vow of poverty, then the saints from that order shouldn't be honored with
monuments
or churches or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't quite make any sense.
Right, yeah.
Like, they're not living in poverty in heaven.
It's true. Yeah.
Anyway, that just made me laugh.
Yeah. Another talk I actually did enjoy was Father Innocent Smith as well. He's on the...
Shout out to him, the original Innocent
Smith. Yeah. Actually, and very, I think the only person there who brought his mother.
Yeah.
Which was really, really funny. But she was a very, very lovely woman, like very interesting character. And
one of the really funny moments the night before the conference, when we arrived there and there was a little reception, we were just meeting some of the people there. The
speakers, yeah.
And the first person I talked to was Father Innocent Smith's mom. I just kind of assumed she was a speaker at first, so I was going to introduce myself like, oh, you know, I'm just kind of an interested layman just visiting. Yeah. And she said something like, it's okay, I'm not a speaker either. Just do it with my son.
Yeah, and her husband was Philip, yeah. Gordon?
Yeah, he was a famous architect in the States. Yeah. One of the leaders of kind of the revival of good architecture in the States.
Right. He designed Clear Creek Abbey, I believe. I think it was one of the places she'd see it said. And then a seminary.
The FSSP seminary, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right, yeah. Mm. Yeah, just it was very interesting. A lot of different speakers. A Polish priest then as well. I can't... It's been a couple of months. Actually, no, it was only last month the talk, but...
Dominic something.
Yes.
Father Dominic.
Yes, Father Dominic, yeah.
I can't remember the Polish last name.
Yeah, that was... Yeah, he had some interesting talks as well, too.
Yeah, and the... what was the name of the Irish
Eleanor. Oh, what was her name? Eleanor. Yeah.
It was great, too.
She
really delved into the Humbert of Romans reforms and the details of their drafts that they made, right, the altar missals and stuff.
Yeah.
That was very fascinating.
She had a lot of time spent on actually looking at actual manuscripts. She would go to universities and actually see them up close firsthand, and I think a lot of her research was into transcribing these and just seeing how they would have fit in see how they were used and kind of speculate how they were used in a daily kind of setting. I thought one of the interesting things is this was in a video that she had posted with her research, how that there was a, because typically these manuscripts are quite large, but she said that they'd come across a 13th century one that was maybe only 8 inches by 6 inches or something like that. And she said, why on earth would this have been kind of that size when typically these are placed on a pulpit and read out loud during mass or celebration. So she was they hadn't quite figured out why a missal would be that kind of small yet. So I'd asked her about her and I was like, oh, well, was it possible that somebody would have been traveling with it? And she said it's a possibility. She said, but I don't think so. She said, I think she did have another reason as to why it may have been something, but I don't actually remember what her suggestion would have been for that.
Did you want to talk about the rosary controversy?
Yeah, I guess.
This was also an interesting talk too on the offices of the penitents throughout, I think, the 13th, 14th century, and just kind of early versions of things similar to third orders, different kind of peasant versions of the divine office, which at this time mostly consisted of praying the Pater Noster a certain number of times and Aves.
Usually, Aves were the Pater Nosters were 14, and the Aves were something 28 or something like that, I think, daily.
Yeah, for the different hours offering them for the dead and stuff like that. So just kind of trying to emulate the religious.
To the extent that they could, that allowed them to, yeah.
But it was kind of strange, I thought, this talk didn't really go into the rosary confraternity or anything like that. And I don't know how it came up, the idea of...
I think there was just a mention made. I think I remember in one of the handouts, it was just they were talking about the Office of Penitence, and then they were going into they were describing how many Aves and Pater Nostras that one would typically do. And then I think it was right near the very end of the talk. It just said and many people believe that Saint Dominic received the rosary from Our Lady, but it's more likely that Blessed Alan was referring, when he was promoting the rosary again after the devotion had kind of waned, that he was actually referring to Dominic of Prussia.
he was confused
between the two of them.
Thought Dominic of Prussia was
Saint Dominic. I remember looking at you and being like, huh?
Yeah.
What? I don't know. And then so I made sure to bring a book tonight to, and I had you read it, of the Catechetical History of the Dominican Order by, I think, Father O'Connor, I believe is his name, for the use of novices by the Very Reverend John B. O'Connor. I believe this is early 1900s. And it kind of very quickly stamps out that notion of St. Blessed Alan being confused between Dominic of Prussia and St. Dominic.
Yeah, there are a number of of arguments in here that seem pretty damning to that position. I wish I had, before the podcast, dug further and got some of the sources. But, like, I mean, according to this, we have documents of indulgence being granted to the Rosary Confraternity in the 1200s. It mentions an existing copy of a will mentioning the Rosary Confraternity in the 1200s, before even the death of St. Dominic.
Yeah, and before the birth of Dominic of Prussia. Which is kind of like, that seems to seal it pretty much, but yeah.
And then the fact that the church had a formal investigation into it in the 1700s.
Right.
I think, I think I'm sticking with the theory that St. Dominic did receive the rosary.
Yeah.
Seems like kind of a
safe bet.
Yeah.
We saw it. We're like, when in doubt, side with the church.
This almost seemed like an instance of like kind of historical critical stuff, like you see with biblical criticism, right?
Where
sometimes in scholarship, it's almost like, I don't know what to call it. It's almost like there's a form of street cred to like disparaging historical. Beliefs about scripture. I kind of feel like the same thing applies to the lives of the saints too,
right?
Where like you want to be taken seriously as a historian, so you gotta agree with all the secular scholars that debunk all this stuff. I don't know if that's I'm not saying that's his motivation, but it just, it seems like a temptation when scholars get into this kind of historical analysis.
It's almost like there's a fear of commitment there that they're like, because like, I think with history, they must believe that like, that there's, because history is open to revision at times and in certain circumstances, I think, I wonder if there's a fear there that if they commit too much to it and then it does end up being revised and it's shown to be something else, then do they look, do they feel as though, well, I maybe I shouldn't have said anything, so maybe be more of a skeptic, or maybe being more critical than is necessary kind of might feel like a safer bet for them. But that's not always a good thing either. It's like, it's didn't seem like a good option for me, but
it struck me as a bit impious. You're a heretic or something, but just like it's not very edifying to hear this kind of.
Remember the there was, I was kind of glad that I had my tertiary manual there, like, because I thought the one of the kind of the office of readings, kind of like the office of penitence, kind of like kind of fit in along with that as well too. So it was kind of nice to see though that the Dominicans have their like historically in the early 1900s, a lot of Dominican tertiaries manuals were printed. I own like just a few copies of them, I think, just different kind of ones over the years. But these were kind of shorter manuals made for, it's kind of like a condensed version of the Divine Office for lay people. So it consists of the normal 7 hours for the day. And a lot of it's actually, it's the Little Office of Our Lady. That's oftentimes because the order is very much dedicated to Our Lady. So they often incorporate the Little Office of Our Lady into the manuals, to be said. So, I mean, in the manuals, it actually does say that you can still do the regular Pater Nostras and Aves if that's what you choose to do instead. So they actually haven't taken that away. It's like, that's still an option for you. Now, what current today's third orders are doing is probably quite drastically different than doing the Office of Our Lady.
Well, I looked up a little more after, because we discussed this on the conference, and it kind of seems like it's decentralized. Like, the rule from the actual Dominican order only has very vague guidelines.
Right.
And the provinces end up setting the rules for what prayers need to be said. So there are some provinces that have a pretty reasonable set of prayers. There's ones that look pretty similar to what Chris and Julie would be familiar with.
Right.
The Carmelites, where as lay people you say, I think, Lauds and Vespers, and then you're required to pray the rosary and do mental prayer and things like that.
Right.
But from what I remember contacting groups up here in Toronto, it was very different. Like, I remember looking for some kind of rule of what prayers are to be said.
Rule of Life, yeah.
And there basically was none to be had.
Oh, okay.
Which is kind of one of the things that, tipped me off to be skeptical, obviously. Mm-hmm. This is way earlier in my life before I would say I was trad or anything. Mm-hmm. Like, I didn't know anything about the Latin Mass.
Mm-hmm.
But I was looking for authentic Catholicism. I was looking to get deeper into the faith. And I kind of knew generally what to expect from Third Orders because I knew Chris and Julie and Chris's mom, who are all Third Order Carmelites.
Mm-hmm.
But this group kind of scared me off. And there was a moment kind of where they had a mass for all the Third Order members and some of the priests up in Toronto. And it was just like so abusive. It was full of like lay people surrounding the altar and like weird
intercessory prayers or something.
Weird like vessels being used on the altar and stuff like that. And just it was kind of like super weird.
Right.
It reminded me of there was weird masses that used to happen at a certain chapel at the University of Waterloo that I had to avoid as a student.
Right.
And it was like full on like 70s weirdness in the mass.
Right.
So that's when I was like, I don't think I can join this group.
Mm-hmm.
But I kind of wonder if it's any different today with the local groups, but I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I remember when I started looking for Third Order groups, I had come across some in Toronto that you were referring to, and there's some out in Vancouver, but I looked to see if there was anything kind of close over the border, and I remember finding one in Massachusetts, and I remember contacting this, because I believe it said Father, I don't remember his name, but it had OP after his name, so I thought, okay, and the website looked very traditional-like, and it just was, I remember there was like, I had two book recommendations about, it did seem very much, right off the bat, it was very much kind of anti-Vatican II, and I was kind of like, okay, or like why the popes can't do this or why the popes can't do that kind of thing. And then, but a lot of the prayers and invocation, like a lot of the prayers and articles were all very kind of traditional minded. But I remember contacting this priest and then, which I thought was a priest at the time, I think, and then he responded back, oh yeah, we'd very much, be open to having you, but you'd have to travel down and hear what the requirements are. And he said, as long as you don't attend SSPX or an indult TLM. And I was kind of like, don't attend SSPX and don't attend a diocesan approved Latin mass. I was like, wait.
So it's a set A group?
I was like, this guy's a set A. It took me a while for the penny to drop, but I was kind of like, huh? What? But yeah, it eventually did set in, and I was like, oh wow, okay. So there's Dominican sedes out there, I guess, or people who are calling themselves Dominicans that technically I don't think they could be because they're not part of the order. So
yeah,
they just kind of appropriated the name.
There are trad Dominicans that are, and we talked about this too at the conference, that are not sede, that are doing the traditional Dominican rite. But they're technically outside the Dominican order.
Mm-hmm.
This is, I think it's the Society of St. Vincent Ferrer.
Yeah, and they're based in France.
Yeah. So I believe they were set a privationist at one point, and then they basically reconciled with Rome and are regularized in the church now, but were formed into their own order. Permission to use the traditional Dominican rite.
Right, yeah.
Although they're a new order and not part of the Dominicans.
Yes, it's kind of confusing. So you look at them, you think, oh, they're Dominicans, but they're an order of their own, but with the name of St. Vincent Ferrer. But it's, it's a beautiful thing that they're promoting the Dominican rite, and they're living the Dominican life. And
I don't think they exist in North America at all, right? Just in France.
They do have quite a few American students who end up joining there, obviously they're all they have to learn to speak French as soon as they go there, much like the Institute of Christ the King. They recommend their seminarians but they do have to actually learn French though, as a, I believe that's a requirement for them across the board.
Oh, is it?
Yeah,
I didn't know that.
I think that was one of the... Yeah, that order is getting bigger over time. Like, and I get their... I think we'd sent like a donation there one time. And now we get their quarterly magazines. It's all in French, so I can't read it. So I just give it to Matt. And they're like, here, Matt. He goes, oh, thanks. Well, I'm not a Dominican, but I'm like, oh, that's okay. There might be some nice articles in there, like secretly hoping that maybe someday. But yeah, I know he's Benedictine for sure, I think.
Yeah, I guess they're part of that whole trend in France where... like an outrageous amount of their seminarians and new priests are in traditional orders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is, I mean, it's a trend here too, but it's especially a trend in France where they've got those traditional seminaries and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And they are secularizing and losing their diocesan priests perhaps even faster than we are.
Right, yeah, it is. It's happening very, very quickly, yeah.
Anything else you wanted to discuss about the conference
before we wrap up? I guess, what was your favorite part of the conference, looking back?
Definitely the High Mass has to be the high point.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the talks, I think the one that stuck in my mind most was Eleanor's, actually, just mm-hmm. because of how much she showed the actual photos and text of the missals and how they were scribed and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That one really was super interesting to me.
They could tell the difference between scribes too.
Yeah.
That was really cool. And they must have gotten, I never asked her this, but they must have got a handwriting analysis person to come in and be able to show that. But that's how one person took over mid-sentence. It's like, wow.
She even showed little details of this person forms the A differently
than
the scribe.
Yeah. And then a beginner didn't leave himself enough space, so a more senior one had to come along and fix it for him.
Yeah.
That
stuff's really cool.
Mm-hmm. What were you thinking?
Yeah. I feel it's tangentially related to my work, because I do programming related to digital forensics. This is almost like a form of forensics on handwriting.
So yeah, handwriting analysis. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. What about you? What was your favorite?
I think very much, the Mass and Vespers. I definitely enjoyed Father Innocent Smith's talk as well on the Dominican chant. But obviously going back to the Mass and the Vespers, just beautiful. I guess Matt pointed this out to me recently, that our Mass isn't actually a high Mass, even though we refer to it, it's something else. Yeah. It's not a solemn high Mass. It's
Misa Cantata is kind of a hybrid
high-low
Mass
kind of thing. it's a thing of itself. But so when I was watching stuff happen, for example, the Gospel being read north-facing, I was he's not even... he's not looking at us, which, that's fine. But I was just not expecting that. I guess at our parish, Father couldn't do that. It would just be kind of just the way that everything's set up, because it's set up for an NO Mass. But I just was confused why is he's not even facing us at all? He's not facing east, but he's facing north. That's very strange. And then when they were moving around the altar, the priest moved slightly, the deacon moved more, so it was kind of like watching the hands go around on a clock.
Yeah.
They had the priest and they had the deacon directly behind him, then the subdeacon and then the acolytes, but they were all in a line, and then they were they would move in unison, but it would just look like the hands around the clock, and it was just, thought that was really, really cool to see.
That was great.
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thanks for coming out to the podcast, Dylan. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Mike, for having me.
Appreciate you bringing your knowledge of the Dominican order and all the kind of stuff you've gleaned from all those eBay purchases.
Yeah. Shit, my wife's listening.
All those rare books that you I really appreciate it.
Yeah, no, thank you very much for having me. Stay tradie.
Thanks so much for listening to today's podcast. What are your thoughts on today's episode? Have you ever seen the Dominican Rite and or any of the other rites of the religious orders? We'd love to hear from you. You can message us on Facebook, DM on Instagram at Theology of the Buddy. You can find us on Twitter at StayTraddy, or you can email us at TheologyOfTheBuddy@gmail.com. You can also send us a voicemail via Facebook Messenger. If you like what you heard today, please consider subscribing wherever you listen to podcasts, rating and reviewing us if you're on iTunes. We'd greatly appreciate it as it helps us to get noticed within the larger podcast community. New episodes are released every other Monday, and we'll save you a seat at the table.